for Indie Media On Air. All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. And first, we have headlines from the Indie Media Network. From indiemedia.org, August 6th, yesterday, was the 61st Hiroshima Day, the anniversary of Hiroshima and the dropping of the atomic bomb. 61 years ago, on 6 August 1945, the first nuclear bomb, Little Boy, a uranium bomb, was dropped on a civilian target, the city of Hiroshima in Japan. 3 days later, on 9th August, Fat Man, a plutonium bomb, was dropped on the city of Nagasaki. These, quote, American acts of genocide, which killed as many as 210,000 people, were unnecessary and were designed to kickstart the Cold War rather than end the Second World War. Protests against nuclear weapons are expected to take place around the world. 80 protests have been organized across the USA. To mark the 61st anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, rallies, vigils, teach-ins, and nonviolent protests will be held in more than 60 cities in 24 states across the country to demand an end to nuclear weapons and wars. Anti-war, nuclear abolition, and indigenous rights groups are focusing on facilities run by the Bechtel Corporation, one of the world's leading nuclear weapons contractors, war profiteers, and violators of indigenous rights. Activists will take place under the banner, from Hiroshima to Yucca Mountain to the Middle East, no nukes, no wars, end war profiteering, support indigenous rights. From IndieBay.org, Josh Wolf, an independent journalist and videographer, was taken into custody on August 9th after a 9 a.m. court hearing. He was found to be in contempt for exercising his First Amendment rights and refusing to provide a federal grand jury with video footage he shot at the San Francisco G8 protest last summer. He could be held until the grand jury expires next July. A press conference was held outside of the city hall at 1 p.m., and at 2 p.m., the San Francisco Board of Supervisors was to vote on a resolution in support of Josh's case. The National Lawyers Guild believes that the grand jury is being improperly used to obtain materials which would normally be protected under California's Reporter Shield Law. From la.indiemedia.org, City Council rules to limit speech. August 3, 2006, Los Angeles City Council has ruled to place new restrictions on the public's ability to address the council during public meetings. The move is seen as a backlash against activists who regularly address the council at council meetings. The new restrictions will allow the council to remove speakers from the hearing based on subjective, quote, rules of decorum, unquote, as determined by the council. The council has also cut the speaker's time in half from 2 minutes to 1 minute. Members of the public are now forbidden from addressing their council person directly, and their remarks now must be addressed to the council as a whole. The restrictions are seen as an effort by this council to limit debate on issues they do not want to address. Free speech and public assembly rights, activists from Venice Beach, the South Central Farmers, and communities around the city fighting unwanted development in their neighborhood are the presumed targets of these new restrictions. We'll be back shortly.
Yeah.
All right, we're back. My name's Chris Burnett, and this is Indie Media On Air. And today we have a show to discuss the recent passing of Murray Bookchin, a well-known writer, activist, and philosopher on issues of ecology, anarchism, activism, and an inspiration to many people who have read his books. And to talk about Murray's life and his work, we have Haya Heller to discuss much detail of what Murray was writing about. Haya Heller is a writer, educator, and activist working in the anti-biotechnology, anti-globalization, and feminist movements. As a longtime faculty member of the Institute for Social Ecology, Heller has been investigating the implications of multinationals, biotechnology, sweatshops, and new international trade apparatuses for women, people of color, farmers, and on democracy throughout the world. Her book, The Ecology of Everyday Life, Rethinking the Desire for Nature, radicalizes questions of globalization, feminism, ecology, and technology. She has also spoken on issues ranging from the shopping mall and the biotechnology laboratory to Ecofeminism 2000, creating an ecofeminist future. Heller, who holds a PhD in anthropology and teaches at Mount Holyoke College, will be discussing many of the aspects of Murray's life. And just to give listeners a sense of who Murray Bookchin was, I'm going to read a few excerpts from Brian Tokar's article that came out in many places last week. It's called The Last Utopian, The Visionary Life of Murray Bookchin. Murray Bookchin, the visionary social theorist and activist, died during the early morning of Sunday, July 30th, in his home in Burlington, Vermont. During a prolific career of writing, teaching, and political activism that spanned half a century, Bookchin forged a new anti-authoritarian outlook rooted in ecology, dialectical philosophy, and left libertarianism. During the 50s and 60s, Bookchin built upon the legacies of utopian social philosophy and critical theory, challenging the primacy of Marxism on the left and linking contemporary ecological and urban crises to problems of capital and social hierarchy in general. Beginning in the mid-60s, he pioneered a new political and philosophical synthesis termed social ecology that sought to reclaim local political power by means of direct popular democracy against the consolidation and increasing centralization of the nation state. And Haya, welcome to Indie Media On Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start off with a little bit about Murray's life, if you can. Maybe give us a sort of a sense of who he was, and we can get into some specifics of his work.
Absolutely. Well, he lived to be 85, so he really lived to see a set of transformations that I think none of us can really ever relate to. He really lived sort of between two different centuries, and so I'm going to sort of give a little glimpse of what that life looked like. He was born in 1921, and it's hard for us to even imagine what the world looked like in 1921. He was the son of Russian Jewish immigrant parents who were socialists. They were secular Jews who came to the U.S., and he was raised in Brooklyn. And he joined the communist youth movement when he was 9 years old. So he was politicized at a very early age. Again, that's something that very few of us can relate to. But in his day, that was actually quite common for young people to become active in political youth organizations. He was very radicalized by that movement, and he broke with it, the Communist Party, in 1937 after Stalin's Great Purge. Some people may or may not be familiar with this, but Stalin took over leading the Soviet Union after Lenin, and he killed a great number of people, millions of people, and disillusioned a lot of people who had been very excited about the Russian Revolution, and one of those people was Murray Bookchin. So when he was only 16 in 1937, after the Great Purge, Stalin's Great Purge, and he kind of renounced communism at that point. At that point, he still remained sort of wedded to the labor struggle, and he was a poor kid. He didn't have means to go to college. He worked first after he graduated from high school as a foundry man. He was a union organizer in the CIO. He did a stint in the U.S. Army. He was an auto worker. And he actually, this is sort of interesting, he participated in the great General Motors strike in 1946, and that was kind of a big turning point in his life. He was 25 years old, and he saw all the compromises that were made between labor and capital. And at that point, he said to himself, I think it's time for a new framework, a new theory. And he spent the next probably 20 years really looking for that theory. And by the time he hit his early 40s, the 60s had rolled around, and he started to look at the environment as sort of both the environment and anarchism as a sort of a homeland or a playing field on which to build his new theory that he called social ecology.
Go on.
Okay.
Well, actually, let me just jump in here and say something about social ecology, because that's a good point to sort of introduce that to people who don't know what it is. And this is from Murray. Indeed, to separate ecological problems from social problems, or even to play down or give token recognition to this crucial relationship, would be to grossly misconstrue the sources of the growing environmental crisis. The way human beings deal with each other as social beings is crucial to addressing the ecological crisis. Unless we clearly recognize this, we will certainly fail to see that the hierarchical mentality and class relationships that so thoroughly permeate society give rise to the very idea of dominating the natural world.
I mean, today it's funny, you know, we take this so for granted that ecological issues have a social, you know, component to them. We saw in Seattle this, you know, this incredible flourish of bonds between labor and ecology groups, et cetera. And we sort of entered this realm when we hit sort of like the 90s and then into the I guess we call them the zeros, the next century. We now take for granted that ecological problems have social causes and potentially social solutions. But when Bookchin started thinking about that in the 50s and 60s, people literally thought he was crazy. He was a leftist who, for the left, you know, in industry and technology and science were things that were seemed to be inherently progressive. And to question progress in that way and to question kind of the industrial trajectory that society was on was considered blasphemous, you know, at the very least, and he was really considered sort of a heretic. But he really was kind of a visionary. He, you know, just in his 20s and 30s, he started to look around and to notice that there were these looming ecological problems, again, that no one in the left wanted to recognize or talk about. And in fact, the only people really talking about those things were environmentalists who had more of a conservationist approach, who wanted to kind of conserve large areas of land to preserve them from being kind of consumed into the kind of capitalist machine. But Murray looked at ecology as both a set of problems. He literally saw there was going to be a collision course between capitalism and nature. And I'll speak a little bit later about how he also saw ecology as a way of thinking about social problems. And that's, you know, I think what makes social ecology even more unique. But really in the 60s, he became very disillusioned with communism. He became disillusioned with the labor movement. And he started looking around in the 60s, and he saw something that was historically unprecedented and really something that could not be interpreted through the traditional Marxist categories, and that was he saw the emergence of the new left and then the new social movements, and he saw a set of historical actors, people on the street that could not be described simply as the proletariat. He saw middle class kids from New Jersey, you know, in their universities, holding up banners and talking about condemning imperialism and talking about freedom and social justice and people fight, you know, wanting to fight the war in Vietnam. He saw the civil rights movement before that. He saw a whole set of actors and people who absolutely could not, again, not be put into the simple categories of proletariat versus the bourgeoisie. And he said, we need a new kind of analysis and a new kind of framework to make sense of these new movements. And he saw ecology as potentially actually providing sort of a space for a trans-class movement. And he sort of later changed his position on that a bit. But in the 60s, when he first started to develop social ecology, he said, here's this issue, you know, ecological breakdown, which he, you know, people were starting to notice that there are definite signs of ecological decline in the 60s. One of the major events that Murray used to talk about a great deal that I just find really fascinating is that when the first shots were taken from the moon, I guess that was in 1969, I might be wrong, one of the hugest structures that they saw man-made structures that they saw from space when looking down at the planet was smog. Some people say landfill. It was also landfill, but it was smog. And this was absolutely devastating for people, that the astronauts came back and sent these shots back from the planet. And to actually see the impact that industrial capitalism was actually having on the planet really kind of blew people's minds. And we started then having this really reoccurring image that we still have very much today, which is the whole Earth photo, which we have to remember we didn't have before 1969, before the first trip to the moon. But that event really created a new kind of environmental consciousness for people, where they started to realize that there was something perhaps mortal or finite about the planet that we were living on and nature, and that there might be some relationship between capitalism and nature. And Bookchin really was the first leftist to draw that conclusion. And again, he took a lot of criticism for making that, for taking that stance.
Let's just define what the new left was and why it was different from the traditional left. I think that's important. And then, you know, the phrase trans class.
Certainly. The old left was, you know, a series of groups that were, could be Leninist Marxists, could be socialists, could be anarchists. And basically after World War II, the old left, certainly under the period of McCarthyism, was really kind of diminished and dissolved. And some people feel that, that when labor was sold out after the great General Motors strike in 46, that that was sort of the end of the old left. With the civil rights movement, and then even more sort of importantly for this discussion, with the emergence of the anti-war movement, we saw the emergence of a new movement called Students for Social Democracy, or SDS. And people were calling for a new left. And the new left, again, was going to incorporate not just a call to have a dictatorship of the proletariat and to create a Soviet Union, but to stop imperialism. And it was an attempt to really bring a diverse group of people and a diverse group of perspectives together to critique militarism, imperialism, etc. But for Bookchin, the problem with the new left was that they were still appealing to and using Marxist frameworks. And one of Marie's first kind of famous essays that people quote a lot is called Listen, Marxist. And he wrote it in 1969. And it was actually a pamphlet that he distributed among students in SDS in the late 60s and early 70s. And Listen, Marxist said, listen, folks, let's stop dragging around Marx. And it's not that we're not all indebted to Marx, but there's ways in which Marxism is going to fail us if we're going to try to look to Marxism as the theory to make sense of what's happening right now. So there were sort of two poles in the new left. One was that wanted to sort of really try to figure out how to revamp Marxism, and you saw a lot of Maoists emerge at that time, sort of third worldists who wanted to kind of proletarianize people in the third world and create revolutions in those parts of the world. And then you had Bookchin, who had a different vision. And his vision was to create a new left that would be very, very different. And what ended up happening to the new left is it kind of withered away and was replaced by what we call now the new social movements, which were black nationalism, feminism, the gay and lesbian liberation movement. The women's movement was certainly a very, very big one, the ecology movement. But the new social movements kind of replaced the new left and kind of lost and ultimately its leftist punch. So a sort of paradoxical thing happened. Bookchin was, I think, excited by the leftist vigor of the new left, but sort of dismayed by the adherence to rigid orthodox Marxism. And then I think he was dismayed when he saw the new social movements kind of then end up losing their leftist framework and leftist perspective. And ultimately, I think he thought that the new social movements ended up becoming not necessarily reformist, but they kind of ended up offering a range of alternatives that, while very robust and exciting, co-ops and women's health collectives and trying to seek reform for people of color and looking at civil rights, et cetera, he still felt that those movements did not carry out the revolutionary potential that they had. So I think he felt always that the new social movements had a trans-class revolutionary potential, but didn't ever really fulfill it.
Right.
And let me define what I mean by trans-class. trans class simply means an issue that affects people of all classes. And ecology, unlike capitalism, potentially affects everyone. If you have global warming, and this is a perfect example, I'd like to sort of, as a side note, mention that Bookchin was actually the first person in 1964 to actually write about global warming and climate change. And again, people thought he was absolutely out of his mind, although he predicted it was going to happen 20 years after it actually started to occur. He thought it would happen at a much more gradual pace. He was shocked to see that it happened in his own lifetime.
You know, I just have to interject here. I was going to ask you, when you brought up that image of the Earth, the photo, it was used recently in Al Gore's film in which he talks about global warming, but of course he doesn't address any issues related to sort of capitalism's effect on the planet. Or, it's in a very, very hands-off type of way, very safe type of way.
Yeah.
And but I think it's incredibly relevant to talk about that and go into, you know, why social ecology and Bookchin's analysis in particular, you know, is relevant here. And
it's extremely relevant. And this is where he differs from people like Al Gore, or, you know, I would put Al Gore sort of, you know, on the reformist end of the environmental movement or ecology movement, which are actually two different things. And I put Bookchin way on the left end. For Bookchin, there is an absolute contradiction between not just nature and capitalism, but freedom and capitalism. And when he saw ecology as a trans class movement, it wasn't just, okay, everybody's going to face ecological demise, and that's going to unify everybody. That wasn't exactly what he was saying. He was saying it could, that ecology had the potential to get people to understand that the world they're living in, that they all face a common fate, potentially, in the form of capitalism. That, as Marx said, that capitalism has a tendency to create a world in its own image. And as Bookchin said, that capitalism, industrial capitalism, has a tendency to simplify ecosystems, to reduce everything, as he used to say, to sand. That basically, as we've seen over the last 30 years, and it's happening at an exponential rate, we've seen, you know, species extinction rates just speeding up. We're seeing the simplification of soil composition. We're seeing simplification of biodiversity on an agricultural level. We're seeing monocropping and loss of domesticated plant biodiversity, as well as indigenous plant biodiversity. We're seeing literally the ozone breaking down and becoming simpler, and letting in ultraviolet rays and melting polar ice caps. I don't want to paint the whole doomsday scenario that everybody, obviously, I assume if they're listening to this show, is probably all too aware of. But what Bookchin offered that was unusual was not just a critique of that problem, but a reconstructive vision, a social and utopian vision. And that is what people like Al Gore does not have. And that's what a lot of people out there today that consider themselves to be either mainstream environmentalists or to be radical ecologists, often they have a pretty good critique of the problem, but they don't have, I think, a viable and visionary solution. And that is what Bookchin offered the world.
Well, I think it comes back to the question of what was the role of anarchism in social ecology, which is the critique of hierarchy and hierarchical institutions and its effect on people's life, not just within the workplace, but within every aspect of our lives.
And that sometimes when I talk about social ecology, I talk about these sort of five different ways that social ecology goes beyond Marxist-based leftist theory, and I'll sort of focus on one of them, and that is this whole notion of hierarchy. That for the old left and folks in the new left, the problem is framed in terms of one of labor, how to solve the problem of who controls the means of production, how to control and reformulate systems of distribution, etc. But the focus is on labor and work, and I call that econocentrism. And Bookchin really, again, he was inspired by the new social movements, and he saw people who were not victims of the proletariat who were active in these movements. And he said, the problem, humanity's struggle, is far broader and far wider and far deeper and much older than a problem of labor. That he actually turned to anthropology in the 70s and really studied the ethnographic record, which is actually quite vast and multiple. And he looked at that for most of human history, we did not live in industrial capitalist societies. In fact, it's really, if you looked at the great timeline of human history, it's really the last 3 minutes that we've been living in this kind of arrangement. But what we did have was hierarchy. And in his magnum opus, which is called The Ecology of Freedom, which I highly recommend people read, it's a fabulous read, and I think it came out with its third edition recently. In The Ecology of Freedom that he wrote in 1982, he talks about how even in the earliest indigenous hunter-gatherer societies, there were forms of nascent hierarchy that he called gerontocracy, that was often domination of the young by the old. There were forms of what we now call patriarchy, or we can call male-female domination. There were classes that were formed that were not based necessarily on material hierarchies yet. That hierarchy actually precedes class as a category historically and sort of philosophically too. So for Bookchin, you could hypothetically create a classless society and still have hierarchy. Hierarchies based on race, hierarchies based on sex, hierarchies based on ethnicity, hierarchies based, et cetera, you know, and on age and
within the family,
et cetera. So for Bookchin, you know, he really makes an adjustment to leftist theory by turning the dial a bit from looking at the hierarchy of class to looking at hierarchy in general. And that makes all of the difference in the world when you now, you know, you take your econocentric glasses off and you put your sort of anti-hierarchy or anti-authoritarian glasses on, you see the world very, very, very differently. And so for Bookchin, to solve the ecological crisis, it wasn't enough to get rid of capitalism and get rid of classes. It was to really create a non-hierarchical society, and that is where he's very original. And he looked to anarchism in the 60s, and he was really, many people sort of debate on who was sort of the father of contemporary anarchism, and personally, I do think it was Murray. In terms of Murray, Bookchin was the person that people were often reading in the anti-nuclear movement, which was one of the places where anarchism and anarchist ideas really kind of germinated in the U.S., particularly in the Northeast in the 70s. People were looking for new forms of political organizing, and they started forming what were called affinity groups. And Bookchin actually brought the idea of the affinity group and that term to the U.S. He'd gone to Spain during the Spanish Civil War and saw that they were organized, the anarchists there were organizing themselves into affinity groups. They were non-hierarchical groups where people made decisions in a non-hierarchical and consensual way. And the groups were based on common interest and sort of common friendship bonds rather than on a very authoritarian hierarchical structure like you would see in a communist party. And he was very inspired by that, and he brought that model to the anti-nuclear movement in the Northeast in the 70s, and he created kind of a culture of anarchism that he published in 1969 this book called Post-Scarcity Anarchism that a lot of people carried around during those years in the early 70s during the anti-nuclear movement. And basically he thought that he needed a new sort of space in which to build a new theory. He felt that Marxism was kind of too filled up with assumptions and assumptions and econocentrism, et cetera, and he thought anarchism, with its critique of hierarchy, would be the perfect place to build a new theory. And so social ecology originally was very much an anarchist theory, and when I met Bookchin 24 years ago, and when I met him, he very much identified as an anarchist. He always specified that he was a social anarchist, and I can say what that meant a bit. And I soon identified as a social anarchist, and most people who were in sort of the social ecology world at that time identified as social anarchists. And what that meant was that we really understood the problem to be, again, not just one of capitalism, not just one of class, but one of hierarchy in general.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk more about Murray Bookchin and his life. Stay tuned.
Do not attempt to adjust your radio dial. This is the Axis of Justice Radio Network.
Hi, this is Tom Morello from Audioslave.
And this is Serge Tankian from System of a Down.
Tune in this Friday at 7 p.m. for the Axis of Justice Radio Network, where we will be spinning rebel jams, revealing dangerous truths, here on fiercely independent KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Just as fearless there.
Okay, we're back. This is Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and you are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the net at kpfk.org. And I am speaking with Haya Heller on the life and work of Murray Bookchin. Haya is a writer, educator, and activist working in the anti-biotechnology, anti-globalization, anti-corporate globalization, I should say, and feminist movements, as a longtime faculty member at the Institute for Social Ecology. And Haya holds a PhD in anthropology and teaches at Mount Holyoke College. So let's continue where we were, talking about social ecology and anarchist influence on social ecology. And then maybe we can talk a little bit more about Murray's feelings of in the last decade, moving away from that towards something he called communalism.
Right. The thing that's really interesting to say about the anarchist piece is that anarchism is one of the most, I think, misunderstood, probably one of the most misunderstood, I won't even call it a theory, but political tendencies out there. And this is because anarchism, unlike Marxism, is not a single author theory. It was more of a sensibility that was taken up by various theorists. You've got Kropotkin and Bakunin and Goldman, and I could go on and on. But there really is not one single anarchist theory. It really was kind of, in a sense, if anarchists agreed on anything, it was that they tend to be anti-authoritarian and anti-hierarchical, but anarchists often disagree greatly about whether there should be a state or not, and whether there should be government of any kind or not. And there's always a tension within anarchism within sort of this question about to what extent should the individual be autonomous and to what extent should that individual be accountable to a collective greater than that individual. And Bookchin's understanding of anarchism and why he always emphasized that he was a social anarchist rather than what he used to call an individualist anarchist is because he really wanted to emphasize that he wanted to build a theory that drew out that social dimension of anarchism, the idea that the individual is always inextricably linked to the social whole and that we are inherently social creatures before we are individuals, that we are, as Aristotle would say, we're political animals, we're social animals before we are individuals. And again, he saw anarchism as sort of an untainted open space in which to build a new theory called social ecology. And he saw anarchism as really a place in which to create a new vision of how we could govern ourselves. And for many anarchists, this, and again, this is why Bookchin is so interesting, is that he, you know, first, he's blasphemous to the Marxists for moving from econocentrism to an anti-hierarchical stance. Then he's kind of blasphemous to the anarchists for advancing a theory about how we should govern ourselves. Because, again, many anarchists are anti-government, period. But for Bookchin, he believed that we needed to actually, he called his vision libertarian municipalism. Or you could call it also communalism, and that is a term that he used more towards the end of his life. He believed that what we needed to have were non-hierarchical, decentralized cities, towns, and villages that were linked together by a common constitution. He didn't see, for him, anarchism was not each individual person conducting their own affairs according to their own inclinations. To him, that was kind of chaos. And there's a fabulous feminist essay that was written in the 60s that I always refer to, which is called The Tyranny of Structuralistness.
Yeah, that's a great,
by a feminist named Doreen. And basically, Bookchin believed this, and he was very, you know, and very inspired by a lot of feminist theorists, that if you leave structure up to sort of personal or individual inclination, you're actually going to have a tyranny of personality over tyranny of reason. I mean, tyranny of personality over justice of reason, et cetera. So he used to talk a lot about what would the forms of freedom look like, rather than saying we're not going to have any structures, which would make space for the tyranny of personality. What would the forms of freedom look like? And for him, it was to create a confederal model where you'd have free cities and towns and villages. And this is what communalism means. Communalism, by definition, is a federation or a confederation of free cities, towns, and villages, municipalities, that are joined together by sharing a common constitution. And Bookchin intentionally never wanted to be didactic or formulaic, because that would go against sort of the poetic and organic nature of his philosophy. So he never spelled out and said, well, these would be the tenets of this constitution. But generally speaking, the constitution that would bind these communities together would be a common agreement about ecology, that they would adhere to ecological, basic ecological principles, about trying to work with ecosystems to enhance them rather than deplete them. Another principle would be social justice, that political and economic and social structures would be there to actually enhance social freedoms around sexuality, gender, ethnicity, et cetera. He also had for principle direct democracy, and if you sort of look at his legacy, one of his major contributions is about direct democracy. He looked to the ancient Greeks, who were one of the first people to introduce that into civil society. There's certainly many indigenous societies that had directly democratic forms for how they governed themselves. But the ancient Greeks did something interesting, that they introduced it into a non-kin-based society, which is more analogous to what we live in today, since we don't live in kinship-based societies generally in the industrialized world. So he looked at the ancient Greeks and saw that they were trying to figure out a way to govern themselves directly, with face-to-face direct democracy, not using representatives to make decisions on behalf of citizens, but actually having citizens get together in a town meeting-like situation and make decisions on their own behalf. And that idea of direct democracy has really taken off and became very popular during the anti-globalization movement. So I was there in Seattle in 1999, and I mean, I just couldn't believe a number of banners and chants about direct democracy, and that is absolutely traceable in many ways to Bookchin. So his take on anarchism was an anarchism based on confederalism, meaning the linking through a common constitution of freed cities, towns, and villages that are coming together around principles of ecology, social justice, direct democracy. And the fourth one is municipalized economics. And this is where I think you see Bookchin as the leftist very, very clearly as well, that he believed that the economy should be controlled by the people who live in the city and town and village, that the economy should be controlled by the citizen, so that you wouldn't have, as you do in anarcho-syndicalism or in communism, you wouldn't have a dictatorship of the worker, or you wouldn't have workers' councils, but you'd have councils that are made up of citizens, citizen councils, civic councils, where people, because they live in a place rather than because they occupy a certain profession, that people who live in a place actually make decisions about the economy. They make decisions about what they're going to produce, how they're going to produce it, how they're going to distribute it, et cetera.
I'd like to jump in here and just remind listeners that we're talking about Murray Bookchin, who passed away on Sunday, July 30th, in his home in Burlington, Vermont, and his work and some of his life and what he represented to people. I just want to let people know some of his work. Bookchin was incredibly prolific. Some of his works include Our Synthetic Environment, Post-Scarcity Anarchism, which you brought up, The Spanish Anarchists, Remaking Society, The Philosophy of Social Ecology, The Ecology of Freedom, and Social Anarchism or Lifestyle Anarchism, and Unbridgeable Chasm.
He wrote 27 books, actually, in all. and hundreds and hundreds of articles.
And, you know, it kind of, one of the quotes on his more recent work that I read, and you can help me here, on communalism, or what he referred to as communalism, he said that capitalism will not generously provide us the popular democratic institutions we need. Its control over society today is ubiquitous, not only in what little remains of the public sphere, but in the minds of many self-styled radicals. A revolutionary people must either assert their control over institutions that are basic to their public lives, which Bakunin correctly perceived to be their municipal councils, which you were sort of referring to, I think, or else they will have no choice but to withdraw into their private lives,
exactly,
as is already happening on an epidemic scale today.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's a really important point, the sort of atomization of people's lives.
Absolutely.
And how people feel totally disempowered and information becoming sort of a key to liberation in itself. And I know that some of your more recent work has to do with information okay, so how does social ecology apply in action? And maybe give us some examples of that, as well maybe some effects on the modern environmental movement. And how does this stuff play out in real life?
Well,
I know it's a big question.
It's a really complicated question. And, you know, I was lucky enough to actually be with Murray in his final hours and to speak with him a great deal over the last few months before he died. And we talked a lot about this, about, you know, what are we supposed to do? You know, he was very aware of the situation in the Middle East. He was very aware of the state, the deplorable state of the world right now, both ecologically and politically and socially. And what he said is that we're very much in a very, very reactionary period of history, where the world is extremely, especially in the U.S., inhospitable to leftist and revolutionary ideas. And personally, I feel very committed to trying to keep a revolutionary tradition alive. And one thing that the Institute for Social Ecology has tried to do is educate young people in particular about, to teach people to be able to reclaim their own revolutionary history and to learn about leftist history. And we really encourage people to create study groups and to ultimately transform their study groups into political groups. And the hope is that people will start to actually politically organize and create. This is going to sound probably very grandiose, but I think we have to think grandiose at this point. To actually create the beginnings of a revolutionary movement, which means we have to start to really talk explicitly about what kind of movement is going to be necessary to transform the current social order into the kind of society that is not just sustainable, because I think that's a very, very modest and actually impoverished goal, not just a sustainable world, but a utopian and lovely and humane world. And not utopian in terms of lakes of lemonade, but utopian in terms of a world where people actually have the time and the health and the vitality to enjoy their lives and to develop themselves. And that is something that anarchists cared a great deal about. When Emma Goldman says, you know, if I can't dance to it, it's not my revolution, that Murray still really retained that anarchist love for the idea of the qualitative, and that life should be utopian and desirable, not just freedom from need and hunger and starvation, et cetera. But the vision would be that people would actually start to study about communalism and libertarian municipalism and would actually start to think about, in very precise, specific terms, about how to transform this society into a new one. That the current society that we're on is atomizing us. We are becoming increasingly depoliticized, meaning we don't see ourselves as political actors.
Or have the language to even discuss it.
We don't even, exactly, and I talk about this internalized capitalism, but it's also internalized statism, where most people, I mean, I teach anthropology at Mount Holyoke, which is a wonderful school, and I have wonderful students, and I'm always blown away when I look into my, you know, my students' faces, and they say, what is capitalism? And they think that the state has always been. And when I talk to them about the fact that you could actually live in a society that doesn't have a state and doesn't have capitalism, where people actually plan their own economy in a rational and compassionate and ethical and ecological way, and that everyday people could actually choose to participate as citizens in governing themselves, their jaws kind of drop. And this is Bookchin's vision. And what I want to sort of, you know, if I have one thing to say and leave the listeners with, is I think that what's very sad to me is that a lot of young people have stopped dreaming, and we've become, lots of people have become very, very cynical. And many of our heroes and the people that inspire us are actually what I call charismatic critics. I don't want to put down Michael Moore because I think he does some fabulous, fabulous critical work in really shedding light on some of the sources of the problem. But one of the problems is that that's what basically all we have are charismatic people showing us the problem. And what we don't have are charismatic people or non-charismatic people showing us a possible set of solutions and offering us a vision that is worth fighting for. And what ends up happening is young people kind of, the kinds of projects I see them working on tend to be more private or social projects. They work on maybe a personal housing collective they live in or a bike co-op or a food co-op. And while those are fabulous projects in terms of giving you, you know, a place of asylum in a very alienating world, I think we saw in the 70s that those don't really create the necessary tension with the existing political and economic order to really overhaul it or change it in any substantial way.
And I mean, dare I say, it's almost disempowering at some point when you're always looking for some new voice to come out and explain things to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and without sort of inspiring people to take action. And I know there are those that do that, but sort of the endless sort of, I don't want to say it in a negative way, but parading of these, like you, these people that you're describing, you know, and then people are left, well, what do I do? And what am I supposed to think about? How do I act? How do I dream? And I think it goes back to one of the things that we, when before we were on air, we were talking about the concept of pragmatism being thrown at people
right.
and internalizing it to the point where, well, that's not possible. That's not,
right.
you know, it's, that's just not the way. If we don't see the, our means getting to our ends, then, well, what's the point of doing it?
Right.
Instead of saying, no, we'll find a way to do it.
And
no.
and that's, you know, I think Murray's message that to me is one of the most inspiring ones and I think is the answer to why he never burned out. I mean, I'm not kidding. He was 85 and a few days before he kind of, you know, really went on a decline, he was sitting in bed writing. I mean, the man never stopped. He was so driven by this beautiful, sumptuous, unbelievably, just incredibly beautiful vision of what he called free nature, humanity living as self-conscious, I mean, humanity rendered self-conscious, living in harmony within humanity and with the rest of the natural world. He was so driven and inspired by that vision that he never gave up hope, he never became cynical, he never became jaded, and he never burned out. Because he wasn't driven by a pragmatic kind of drive for what is possible. He always was striving for what is potential. And he would look through history. He would take a comb and sort of comb through the strands of history and look for little diamonds in the past that could serve as models for the future. And he'd string those diamonds together and he'd say, see, look at that. That is, you know, and he'd string them together. That's the pathway that we can take. And when I would do lectures to people, they'd say, well, you know, so many of my friends have burned out, and they'd be in their 20s or 30s. And I'd say, you know, I have a friend at that point who's 83, he's 84, he's 85, and he's not burned out precisely because he has a vision, and he is always striving for what is ethical rather than what is practical and pragmatic. And I think that if we get mired in, again, is this going to be achievable in my lifetime? I think we'll throw our, you know, hats in the ring and just sort of give up. But if we look and say, I'm going to do what's right rather than what I think is going to necessarily be successful, I think we'll have so much more staying power. And this doesn't mean you go and try to create a revolution that is insurrectionary and self-destructive and ultimately it's probably doomed to fail. It means you try to create a grassroots, educated movement for direct democracy that's informed by both hope and reason.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that we can't go and build
doable.
A utopia on the moon and
no.
institute
no.
Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed or something like that, even though it sounds
right.
great.
Let's, no, there's but no there, other planet so far.
Right, we need to have some sort of technological and material reality temper
right.
us when we make plan that.
Really, I mean, I don't know any other thinker who took the time, basically his entire life, to figure out how would that look like. And he looked at the Swiss Confederacy that lasted for 200 years. It was a confederal system that was, you know, a stateless confederal system. He looked at the Greek tradition. He looked for models. So it's not pie in the sky. That would be shooting yourself in the foot in a completely different way. He looked for real potentialities that exist in history and that exist within us now. And he said, let's build on those. And what I would love to inspire people to do is to find Bookchin's work and read it and start a study group and start a discussion and connect with the Institute for Social Ecology and look for guidance and look for mentors to reignite that kind of hope and that kind of optimism. Again, not a blind optimism, not a blind hope, but an informed one that's informed by history. Towards the end of his life, he dedicated actually more than the last decade of his life to looking at history. He became so interested in where the left went wrong. And he wrote, he was working on the fourth volume of a series called The Third Revolution, and it's a beautiful collection, and I really encourage people to read it. And he really combs through leftist history and, again, tries to find those little diamonds in a rough and tries to figure out what can we learn from those mistakes and those achievements. I mean, one of his favorite moments in history is the French Revolution and the Parisian sections. They were little, basically kind of federal affinity groups that could have formed the basis for a direct democracy. And he was looking at why didn't it go that way and how could it have gone that way and how could we build on that today? And again, you know, I think we're so impoverished today looking for visionaries, and we confuse charismatic critics. We confuse them for visionaries, and we need visionaries. And I'm hoping that, you know, with the great loss of this incredible man, I mean, I can't describe what an incredible humanitarian he was. I'm hoping that with passing, it may inspire, and I believe it will inspire particularly young people to read his work and get to know what he was thinking about. And he so wanted to speak to young people now. He was so excited by the anti-globalization movement that was kind of snuffed out by 9/11, but he was so excited about the new movements that were emerging. And he was speaking to people from all over the world. We got messages from people all over the world, from the Kurds in Turkey, it was just endless, people who were looking to him for inspiration. But he truly, we need visionaries. We don't just need critics, and we need a model for where we can go.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you think that with this coming and clearly massive crisis of global warming and environmental collapse, species extinction on a rate we've never seen before, I mean, how will that play into, and is it possible to ignite that with these sort of more critiques of hierarchy and class, and do you see that happening? And just in general, what's your hope for that? And that sort of the waking up in this crisis sort of activating.
It's funny, kind of, you know. I remember when Three Mile Island happened. I knew Marie during that time, Chernobyl. No, I did not know him during Three Mile Island. Chernobyl. I remember writing an editorial in the paper and him sort of helping me with it. I was a young person at that point. And I said, you know, the first line of my article was, I think this is finally the last straw. You know, we thought Chernobyl was the last straw. But we thought it was like the final wake-up call because we couldn't even imagine the kind of things that have happened since then. And he said to me, you know, that's really not necessarily the way to go. If you keep waiting for the last straw, you're going to run out of straws. And things can get very, very bad. And the fact that things get very bad does in no way mean things are going to get better. So I don't think that ecological is in any way going to inspire great things from people. I think quite to the contrary, I think we need to take these moments before things have gotten completely out of control to really start to educate ourselves and to have a model for how to reconstruct society available, so that if the opportunity, if the political climate shifts and an opening emerges, that there will be a model for us to grasp onto and to build ourselves and to embroider upon.
Hi, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, and I really wanted to continue that answer.
But
where can people go to get more information about social ecology?
We have a website that hopefully is in transition, and I'm hoping that it's going to be robust and exciting place to be, where you can download all kinds of interesting articles. And it's social-ecology.org.
Social-ecology.org. And also check out Murray Bookchin by Googling his name, and you should probably be able to find a lot of information. Haya, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Indie Media On Air today and for this wonderful discussion about a beautiful man who just recently passed away, Murray Bookchin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank engineer D'Angelo Jones and producer Alan Minsky. I'm Chris Burnett, and I'm out.
You've been listening to Indie Media On Air on radio powered by the people, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and universally at kpfk.org. More revolutionary community radio and voices from the front line is up next. Keep it tuned.
Hi, I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host of Uprising. On August 14th at 7 p.m., there will be an important discussion with CIA analyst Ray McGovern about the history of U.S.-Iran